of the debates that came out of people's viewing of that blockbuster film, Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, aside from the issue of anti-Semitism and the other things, the debate about the violence depicted in this film, not only its graphic nature, but how accurate was that violence, the manner of Christ's suffering, the beating, the crucifixion? Was it really as bloody as that popular film depicts it? We're going to be talking about a medical perspective on the physical suffering and death of Christ here in the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. today. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Gene Rudd from the Christian Medical and Dental Association joins us here in the first 25 minutes for that conversation. We'll get his take on that, on the accuracy of the film first, and then we'll walk through the various stages, the various events that took place in the physical suffering and death of Christ from a medical perspective. That's the first 25 minutes. Then Dr. Paul Meyer has been kind enough to join us for just a few minutes there after the bottom of the hour. He's professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. You may have seen him on television last night. Briefly, I am told, he appeared on Peter Jennings' special on Jesus and Paul. And apparently his viewpoint, along with the other viewpoints of more conservative scholars in that documentary, were probably outweighed by those of more liberal scholars. We'll let Dr. Paul Meyer have his brief say about the ABC TV special Jesus and Paul in about 25 minutes, and then we'll round off this first hour of Issues Etc. talking with Paul Coughlin. He has written a review. We've had him on before. He has that book called Secrets, Plots, and Hidden Agendas, which you don't know about conspiracy theories. Well, he's also written a review of Dr. Laura's latest book called The Proper Care and Feeding of Husbands. Dr. Laura is known for her less than politically correct views about men and women. We'll see what Paul thinks about her latest book, rounding off the first hour of Issues Etc. today. It doesn't end there. That's three guests in the first hour alone. We've got four that followed that. In the second hour, Dr. Andrew Steinman joins us to talk about Passover. That is being celebrated today. Carol Cross from Democrats for Life joins us to talk about pro-life Democrats. You might think that there isn't such a thing. Yes, there is. We'll talk about it in the second hour. In the third hour, Dr. Jane Healy joins us. We'll talk about the connection between attention deficit disorder and television viewing. And finally, we'll talk again about that ABC TV special that was on last night, Peter Jennings' Jesus and Paul. We'll talk about that with Gretchen Passantino, who watched it diligently last night and, lo and behold, already has a review posted at the answers.org website, her website for Answers in Action. I should know this after 5 years of saying that. Gretchen Passantino will join us for always a much looked forward to visit to talk about the special many of you saw last night on ABC. That's the lineup for Issues Etc. today. If you'd like to join us anytime during these 3 hours, feel free to do so at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Gene Rudd is Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association in Bristol, Tennessee. He joins us for a medical perspective on the physical suffering and death of Christ. Dr. Rudd, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Good to be with you.
We're really calling upon you to do the physician's task here to talk about these things. First of all, your perspective on Mel Gibson's film and its depiction of the violent acts, the suffering and death of Christ.
Two words come to mind, Todd. Powerful and accurate. There are some issues that are debatable, I suppose, and it, perhaps in some ways it doesn't show all the suffering aspects of scourging and crucifixion, but on the whole I think it did an excellent job, having looked through numerous archaeological and historical accounts of crucifixion, separate from what the gospel accounts are, and looking at some of the medical literature on crucifixion. I found the movie to be surprisingly accurate in its portrayal of the horrors of scourging and crucifixion. Many of my friends walked out as well saying, could this possibly be so? And I think the answer is understood when we know what the intent was of crucifixion. It was not just to kill someone, capital punishment, but it was intended full well to be a deterrent to the next person who might consider a crime against the state or rebellion against the state. They wanted it to be a very horrific deterrent.
You've mentioned scourging and crucifixion. You also talk about kind of four stages, if you will, of the physical suffering of Christ, beginning with what's often strikes people as the most odd. That is a suffering that's not brought about by any abuse from an outside party, but there in the Garden of Gethsemane, it appears that at least a physical manifestation of Christ's inner agony is evident from one of the gospel writers who talks about Jesus there in his agony in the garden, sweating like great drops of blood. How do you explain this from a medical perspective?
Well, it does have a medical explanation, and it gives more credibility to the Gospels, actually, when you know that. There are modern medical articles that talk about patients who have a condition called hematidrosis. It occurs primarily when patients are in extreme emotional states. It has rarely been described to people who have some kind of blood clotting disorder, but it does occur to people who have normal blood clotting factors, but under extreme emotional state, I could explain the details, but we don't have time, of how the capillaries actually burst and bleed into the sweat glands, and then out comes a mixture of the sweat and the blood. It's one of the explanations for why we have some modern-day record of stigmata, of people have manifestations on their skin. And I think the movie did a good job of showing that. It would not look like pure blood, but it'd be a watery blood that beads up. And typically, in these situations, the skin is left very tender, sometimes irregular, and the pain associated with this could be very distracting to an individual.
Now, the second stage of the physical suffering, I would call it the roughing up stage. He's not being officially beaten as a punishment, but he is being knocked around, and this takes place, of course, in the trial before the Council of Elders. What kind of suffering does Christ undergo there, and how would that have left him?
You know, first he was taken from the garden to Annas, who was the previous high priest, and it may actually be Annas who was the ringleader in the conspiracy against Jesus. That's why he was taken there. Annas still had a tremendous amount of influence in the Jewish community. He actually may have been the most influential person because he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the current high priest. But he was first taken to Annas, and we have biblical account of him being struck in the face while there. And then being taken to Caiaphas in the Sanhedrin, being found guilty, he was mocked, spit upon, and beaten. And from what we know about the punishment that was meted out from the Sanhedrin in terms of beating, it was no small insult to the body. It probably would not have put him in any kind of serious physical condition, but it would have been a beating worthy of having him maybe go to an emergency room and being treated for that. So those two were the first physical insults inflicted on him by others, first before Annas and then before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin.
Now, there's another biblical account of such a beating at the hands of the Sanhedrin that takes place in the book of Acts, where I believe it is Peter and several other apostles who, after having been tried for healing in Jesus' name, are beaten by the Sanhedrin. This is not just people walking up and smacking him in the face. This is a formal beating. This is a caning kind of a thing, isn't it?
It very well could have involved some instrument. In fact, it probably did, more so than just fists and hands and slaps. Paul and Silas were beaten and thrown in prison, and we don't have a physical description of that kind of beating, but we know from historical accounts that these were not minor events.
Let's then talk about at least the section of Christ's physical suffering that in the Gibson film, in most people's immediate memory, is most lasting, and that is the scourging at the hands of the Roman soldiers.
Todd, scourging is a horrific punishment in and of itself. Often people were just assigned to have scourging and nothing more, and many people did not survive scourging. In fact, it was so brutal that Roman citizens were most often excluded. All women were excluded. Roman senators were excluded. And soldiers, unless they were deserters, were excluded from having the scourging punishment applied. Scourging was frequently done, though not always done, in accompaniment to a crucifixion. And we know that the severity of the scourging was inversely related to the amount of time that a victim could subsequently survive on the cross, meaning that the more severe the beating, the less time the victim would live on the cross. And we have evidence, of course, that Jesus died on the cross before the other criminals. And we have some inference from Scripture. If you look at 2 Peter, it talks about the beating of Christ, and it describes in the original language it being an unusually harsh beating that he took at the hands of the Romans. And where the Jewish law restricted flogging or scourging to 39 stripes, Roman law didn't restrict it. It was based on the severity of the crime, what the judge issued as a punishment, and the temperament of the lictors. And we have every reason to believe that they intended to make an example of Jesus. It's very common at Passover time for rebellions to start, and the leaders wanted to be set an example of, so, and killed in a most horrific way so that the others would not be tempted to do the same.
Dr. Rudd, the Gibson film depicts kind of a two-stage scourging, one with canes, and then just when you think you can't bear to watch it anymore, they take out the flagella, the actual whip of cords with glass or steel or metal or bone at the end of that.
History records different devices being used for these scourgings. The most common was the flagrum or the flagellum, which was a wooden handle with leather thongs, and tied into those would be bone or metal, obviously for the purpose of cutting the flesh. We don't know specifically what instruments were used with Christ, but taking the most common example being a flagrum, and actually there are historical accounts where people have observed a scourging and wrote about it in some detail, where the back, the buttocks, and the thighs would actually be laid open by these sharp devices striking the skin. And there were even descriptions of where the muscle would be torn away from the skeleton and quivering ribbons of muscle would be left hanging from the body. The scourging can be that severe. And, you know, I think there is some poetic license that the movie makers took in describing the different types of instruments being used, the fact that he was beaten on the back and then rolled over and beaten on the front. We don't know those things, but certainly the severity of the beating, the scourging that Jesus took in that movie is consistent with what we know from scourging historically.
Now, along with that comes, and Gibson does depict it, of course, in the popular film, various abuses by the guard as Jesus is incarcerated, the crown of thorns. At the end of this entire, what seems an interminable time of suffering at the hands of the Romans, what physical condition would Jesus have been found in from a medical perspective?
Oh, Jesus would have been in a serious state of health, critical perhaps, certainly deserving to be in the hospital, probably in an intensive care unit. You know, and when I was restudying these scriptures, and I got through the part where he went through the scourging, and that was a direct punishment that was given to him by the judge, by Pilate, then the soldiers did something that was not, they were not commissioned to do. They put the crown of thorns on, they put the robe on, they gave him a staff as a mock scepter, but then they took it from him, and I actually wept when I read these scriptures. They took that staff from him and beat him repeatedly about the head and face, is what the scriptures say there. And that was an additional affliction to a man who's already been beaten just short of his life. And it shows you a little bit of the temperament of the people who were inflicting this punishment.
We go on to the crucifixion. We're talking with Dr. Gene Rudd of the Christian Medical and Dental Association in Bristol, Tennessee, getting a medical perspective on the suffering and death of Christ. Dr. Rudd, what would the crucifixion have entailed?
Well, we know from history that it involved always some kind of wooden structure into which the body was hung. It could have been hung with ropes, which there's some accounts of. It could have been hung with a combination of ropes and nails. But nails only were very common, and when nails only were used, at least there's some archaeological evidence that the nails were commonly put through the wrist. Yes, it could have been put through the palms, and that's what I guess we traditionally think of. And people think that because when Jesus went to his disciples after the resurrection, he said, "Look at my pierced hands and my pierced feet." But the word Jesus uses there in the original language is an anatomical word that could refer to any part of the lower arm or hand. So it's not inconsistent with Scripture to think that the nails actually pierce the wrist, because Roman soldiers would have known that if you put a nail through a palm, it's very likely to pull through the flesh, and the body would fall off the cross during the process of crucifixion. So the most secure site would have been through the wrist, and there's plenty of archaeological evidence that that's what happened. Now, putting one of these nails through a wrist, these nails are typically 5 to 7 inches long, and they're tapered, and putting that nail through there would have certainly done some damage as it pushed the carpal bones aside, but it would have likely also severed the median nerve, leaving the hand dysfunctional but also in excruciating pain and probably in a claw-like fashion. But the wrists were pierced with the arms outstretched on the cross member, and then the feet would be nailed typically on top of one another, as often depicted in the art that we see today, and they would have been nailed to the front of the post. And to really understand the horror and the suffering of the cross, you really have to understand a little bit about the physics and the physiology that happens with your body hanging from nails while in that position. And if you're where you can, you just extend your arms out above your head, and you realize that your chest, it gets expanded. And when you're hanging with all your weight from these nails and your chest expanding like that, it's impossible to fully exhale. And in that condition, you have a buildup of carbon dioxide, probably some lack of oxygen, but soon your muscles start to cramp from that buildup of carbon dioxide, and you've got such an overwhelming urge to take a breath that you have to force your body to move up the cross in order to fully exhale and take in a deep breath. Now think about that for a moment. With all your weight on these nails, your back has already been laid open by scourging. Your back is up against an old rugged cross, and I just challenge you, the next time you sing that song, you'll have a new perspective on that. But that back up against that old rugged cross has to rub up as it moves up. And not only that, your extended arms now have to bend at the elbows, and they have to rotate on the wrist where those nails are pinned to the cross. And the pain and suffering inflicted by just that movement up the cross to breathe is beyond our comprehension. But that's what Christ had to do to take deep breaths, which he had to do periodically to stay alive. And as long as he had the strength to do so, he would have pushed himself up the cross to take a breath, or perhaps to utter one of the expressions that he uttered from the cross. And it was fully intended that victims on a cross would die from either a sudden cardiac event or from asphyxia. That was the intended way for victims to die. So therefore, if a Roman soldier wanted to hasten the death, which they did to the two criminals beside Jesus, they would have broken the legs. Why? Because no longer do you have the strength to push yourself up the cross to take a deep breath, and shortly after having your legs broken, you would die. But we know from Scripture and from some later physical account that Jesus was already dead, and the Roman soldiers knew that. So rather than break his legs, which was consistent with Scripture, which said, you know, a bone would not be broken, but rather than break his legs, they took a spear and they thrust it through his side, again, an anatomical term that would be consistent with the rib cage. And any Roman soldier would have been schooled on where to place a spear, you know, through the chest into the heart. And you can foresee the angle of thrust coming up through the lungs and into the heart. And one of the most remarkable things in this whole story from a medical perspective is the account from John's Gospel. Now, if Luke had been there, a physician, he might have written about this, but we don't have any evidence that Luke was standing at the foot of the cross, but we do have evidence that John was standing there with the mother of Jesus. And John wrote that when that spear was thrust into his side and pulled out, out flowed blood and water. Now, that may seem odd to people until you know the physiology and the medical condition going on inside the body. First of all, Jesus would have had a consumption of his clotting factors due to all the trauma that he had undergone. He would have lost, you know, a lot of his platelets and all the other chemicals that are necessary to clot blood, and by that time his blood probably couldn't clot very well, if at all. And secondly, during all that trauma, there's a collection of a clear fluid on the outside of the lungs and the heart called a pleural effusion. We also call it a hydrothorax. And that's typical in patients who've had massive trauma. And for that fluid to collect there and then to have his side pierced and outflows blood and water, John would have had no reason to create a story like that. He didn't understand the medicine. But his eyewitness account does bear witness to the very things that we know would be going on inside of Jesus' body under such a traumatic situation.
The Roman soldiers are a bit astonished that Jesus has died so quickly. With only about a minute and a half here, from a medical perspective, how would you account for what the Roman soldiers, who were accustomed to watching these deaths, would have considered a swift demise?
Well, I think the answer to that goes back to the brutality that he had experienced before being placed on the cross. He was probably, like I said, in a critical state. He might have had loss of blood down to a point of hypovolemia, all predisposing a very short time of life on the cross before they recognized his death.
Aside from these physical things we've talked about for the last 20 minutes or so, Dr. Rudd, Jesus says before his crucifixion, and it's beautifully recounted in the Gibson film, and I hope that this is the kind of thing that Christians are hearing from their pulpits as well during this Holy Week. He says, "No one takes my life from me. I lay it down of my own accord. I lay it down so that I may take it up again, and I receive this command from my Father." Can medicine really touch upon what is going on in the suffering and death of Jesus Christ?
We can't fully understand that. We can only understand that it was a horrible thing, but then to think that someone, the Son of God, would be willing, and God would be willing to let his Son do it, is just beyond our comprehension. I find that story totally compelling, that God would allow that to happen for me, knowing that there was at least one red blood cell that was shed for me, knowing that that work on the cross, when he said it was finished, was done for me, and knowing that, remembering the parallelism between Adam having a rib taken from his side to create his bride and Jesus having that spear thrust in his side from which we have the possibility of being his bride. That blood was shed for me and for you and for everyone listening. And we can be part of that bride when we confess him also to be Lord and Savior.
Dr. Gene Rudd, we thank you for your time and your perspective on these events of Holy Week.
Thank you.
Dr. Gene Rudd is Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical and Dental Association in Bristol, Tennessee. You can visit them on the web at cmdahome.org, cmdahome. You can also read a tremendous resource titled The Physical Suffering and Death of Christ on their website and download it from that website at cmdahome.org. When we come back from this break, Dr. Paul Meyer joins us for a few minutes. Last night, Peter Jennings, another special on Jesus, this one Jesus and Paul. And you might have seen Dr. Paul Meyer briefly in that documentary, that three-hour special. Dr. Paul Meyer will join us. We'll find out what he thought about this special and perhaps even his part in it as well. That's coming up in just a few minutes here after this break. This is something we should never forget, especially as we trek through this Holy Week again, already Tuesday of Holy Week. Jesus, by this time, is resolutely set toward the cross. He knows what lies ahead for him. He speaks those words, "No one takes my life from me," knowing full well, far beyond what we can imagine, far beyond what we can know, the suffering, physical and spiritual, that he would endure for us. And he says it with joy and with resolution, "I lay down my life of my own accord. This is what I do willingly." The reason he did it willingly was because he was doing it for you and for me as a payment for our sins. That's why he's willing to do it. And he lays it down to take it up again. He is obedient to the command of his Father in his death and his resurrection for us. When we come back, Dr. Paul Meyer will talk about last night's ABC TV special.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do you know God's will for your daily life? Is God's will a mystery? Do we need to look for a sign from God to know what to do at any given moment? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I've written an article in the latest edition of the Issues, Etc. journal titled Locus and Focus, God's Will for Your Daily Life. The recent issue also contains a review of Armageddon, the latest in the Left Behind series, and Aaron Wolf details his spiritual journey to the Reformation from the legalism of evangelicalism. His article is titled, A Beggar on the Wittenberg Trail. Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources. You can receive the next edition of the Issues, Etc. journal by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172, or write Issues, Etc. Journal, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117.
And it turns your attention to starting churches in a short cycle. The idea comes from the book of Acts, chapter 13 and 14, where the Apostle Paul started four churches in 18 months. In Poland, there's a pastor who has a track record of starting churches. He's going to work with a team from Avant Ministries in an effort to start more churches in as brief a time as possible. The vice president of field ministries for Avant is Scott Harris, and he says that this philosophy relies on local people who have credibility. Harris also says that Avant Ministries in different cultures are praying to find local people who already have questions about Christ. Avant Ministries is the new name for Gospel Missionary Union, a mission agency with a successful history of church planting efforts worldwide. Pray that this approach will result in more unreached people worshiping Jesus Christ. Get information by visiting the website www.avmi.org. That's avmi.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. I'm sensing that it'll slip by if I don't do something today, even now. No other week is like Holy Week, a spiritual feast of repentance, of sorrow and joy, of losing our selfish selves in the mystery of a loving God. But I'm afraid Holy Week will end up a fast food drive-thru if I don't prepare for it now. Our Jewish friends are observing Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Two practices offer insight. Before Passover, all leaven is removed from the Jewish house, even down to the crumbs in your couch. When the festival does come, the house is ritually searched for leaven. Some was set out on purpose, to be found and then burned. Like the real search and the ritual search for leaven, Holy Week will have a deeper reach into your being if you start scouring your soul now for the leaven, searching your heart and conducts now to identify what needs God's change, the dying to sin, the rising to new righteous living that Holy Week is all about. Our Jewish friends call the days before the feast days of preparation. Days of preparation for you, or will it be going, going, gone?
Hi, this is Paul Clayton. I bring you news and information, inspirational Christian favorites, and conversations with great guests Monday through Friday on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO. Plus, short features like, By the Way, Our Thought for the Day from the Reverend Paul Devanteer, Front Porch Parenting with Dr. Mary Mance Simon, commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer, It's the Meyer Minute, plus Your Creation Moment. Features on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Dr. Paul Meyer joins us here for a few minutes here at the bottom of the hour. In our first hour of Issues, Etc., he's professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, and he's author of several books, including his latest, More Than a Skeleton. You might have seen him last night, briefly. It was a very brief appearance on the ABC TV special Jesus and Paul Put Together by Peter Jennings. Dr. Paul Meyer, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hi, I put in 8 appearances. What's this very brief bit?
Well, I guess
of course, I counted them naturally.
Yes, but to some it may have seemed brief because the preponderance of the program seemed to outweigh the things you had to say. How your perspective, first of all, on the overall special on how it did in explaining Jesus and Paul and Christianity in general.
They had several of these interviews in the can, you know, months ago, and the thing's been languishing for quite a while. And then they figured there were some open areas they hadn't covered yet, and that's when they contacted me. That's why some of my interviews were shorter than the others. But we got a couple of good licks in, I think. Generally, this version was much fairer in terms of Peter Jennings' first attempt here, which was In Search of Jesus, some moons ago, which was heavily weighted with the radical revisionists getting so much of the time. It was almost disgusting. This time, however, I think it was much better balanced. Last time, Robert Funk, the founder of the Jesus Seminar, and John Dominic Crossan were constantly being interviewed, and it really lurched the thing awfully to a skew angle. This time, I was thrilled to see that Robert Funk, the founder of the Jesus Seminar, got only one interview. That's fine. and the Irish leprechaun, you know, John Dominic Cross, and he always shows up, you know, and he's always good copy. He's the one who said Jesus' body wasn't buried, it was eaten by dogs. You know, things like this, lovely statements. Fortunately, they were pretty well kept in a corner.
What would you say to someone who watched that last night, may not have seen The In Search of Jesus previous documentary, and said to themselves, it looks like biblical scholarship is pretty much completely undecided on the factual nature, the historicity of this Jesus character and the claims of Christianity?
Yeah, I would say this would be a false impression, which was conveyed, however, last night. You're right. And the fact of the matter is that 90-95% of world Christendom agrees on the traditional account, and you're only going to find, some of the scholars by way of exception, not all by any means. There's a whole main van of biblical scholars who are very, very much defensive, and correctly so, in terms of the biblical record. So you're going to find, in the attempt to give equal time, it seems like we're balancing off 95% against 5%, which doesn't seem quite fair to me either.
Are scholars, archaeologists, historians such as yourself, Dr. Meyer, are they without any resources when it comes to delving into first century matters, in particular the first century life of Jesus Christ?
No, I'm just amazed at the amount of outside material we do get from the ancient world. It's not just the scriptural record, but we have all kinds of secular evidence that names people who are in the Bible, that reports on similar episodes, that talks about similar place names, in which we can kind of key the biblical version into the secular context, and we find all kinds of beautiful correlations. In fact, I've been having a hobby of that for the last 25 or 30 years, and that is to match up the evidence secular with the evidence sacred inside the scriptures, and I find you can build all kinds of bridges between the two. The points of tangency are all over the place.
What about last night's program treatment of the person of Paul?
Well, I think we're going to find some of those. We found some of those scholars that are a little bit, they went a little overboard. Calvin Butts, for example, said that Paul was embellishing and or exaggerating Jesus' message. I don't think that's the case at all. They tried to, I think, drive a wedge between what Jesus taught and what Paul taught. I don't find that at all. I find in the case of Paul an augmentation of what Jesus had certainly already taught. And we have some, curves that should not have been mentioned. For example, Elaine Pagels talks about Jesus as an illiterate man. That's just totally ridiculous. Even at age 12, of course, he's able to amaze the scribes by his knowledge. And he reads from the from the scroll of the prophet Isaiah in the synagogue in Nazareth. That's just a little foolish, therefore, to say that. And there were other historical errors that some of them made. For example, the Peter Jennings Guide in Rome had it wrong. He said that Nero had his mother drowned. It was an attempted drowning. He had her beaten to death, actually. Circus Maximus was next to the Vatican. No, it's across town. It's, little things like that that an ancient historian would pick out.
Well, and it probably just drives you crazy.
Oh, yeah. I just don't like these exceptions. For example, in the film on Jesus for Mel Gibson. I mean, they called Pontius Pilate a consul, for goodness sake, and that's just wrong. That just bridles me when I see that kind of stuff.
So to the general impression that was given on the ABC TV special that Jesus was kind of the simple Jewish philosopher slash rabbi who, through kind of hook and crook, ends badly and tragically sticking in the minds of his followers, Paul later picks up and invents Christianity. What's your response?
Well, that would be, I think, a somewhat extreme reaction of what was shown last night, but this is exactly the message from some of our radical theologians today. There's no Crossan suggests that he wasn't buried. You've got Funk saying that Judas was a fiction. And there were no Jewish trials. It's just ridiculous. They, of course, had a very, very low role this time, I'm so happy to see. But again, you're going to find the wrong view, I think, conveyed of Pontius Pilate in that series. The whole present trend, of course, is to suggest that the Bible is anti-Semitic, and it shifts the shifted the blame for Good Friday from Pilate, who really wanted to get Jesus. They whitewashed him and instead blamed the Jews. And this is all unjustified. We have to interpret the Bible correctly. Never draw anti-Semitic conclusions from it, of course, but we can prove there was a Jewish prosecution on Good Friday, however small this group might have been. It's tragic, again, that any anti-Semitic conclusions ever were drawn, but you don't change history. And this is what happens so often. And I'm glad that kind of Mel Gibson, maintained the integrity of this gospel story according to the New Testament rather than giving in to this criticism.
We're going to be talking in the last 25 minutes of the program today with Gretchen Passantino, who has written a overnight review of the ABC TV special.
She just interviewed me about 3 hours ago.
Oh, did she? That's good to hear.
Yes, she did.
Good to hear. Great minds are running all in the same circles here. She observed that the conservative scholars, among whom she names you, along with Luke Timothy Johnson and Ben Wetherington and others, she says that they were quoted, or at least it was her observation, that they were quoted last night in the special as though they agreed with liberal scholars, when in fact they do not. Was that your impression?
Well, the problem is when you have cut after cut cemented together, you can't tell who you're next to, see? And so when somebody drops a little mini bombshell and then I would be next in line, I didn't know where I was being edited, and I wouldn't know who was just next to me on the film. And so for that reason, it may seem as though we're condoning something when in fact we're not at all.
Finally, Dr. Meyer, as to the reliability of the primary sources that we have to the life and the ministry of Jesus Christ, the New Testament Gospels, give us your scholarly opinion on the reliability of those texts.
No question about the basic reliability. The whole background is accurate. The same people and places and events that are recorded in the Gospels, many of them can be found in purely secular sources outside of the Gospels or the writings of Flavius Josephus. And there are all kinds of ways of checking out the credibility of the biblical documents, and they come out very, very well indeed. There's just no reason to become revisionist about it and say that they don't convey the true story.
Dr. Paul Meyer, thank you so much for giving us your time and for continuing to get in there in the public square and fight for the truth.
Thank you much.
Dr. Paul Meyer is professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. He's author of several books, including his latest called More Than a Skeleton. By the way, folks, tomorrow on the program, we're going to be reviewing Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. Pastor Richard Stuckwish, he's also Dr. Richard Stuckwish, will be our guest. He's pastor of Emmaus Lutheran Church in South Bend, Indiana. And we're going to be talking, as we've kind of laid the foundation here in the first half hour or so of Issues, etc., on how to properly meditate on the Passion of Christ, knowing who Jesus really is, what he really came to do. Pastor Paul McCain of Concordia Publishing House will join us tomorrow on the program to talk about how to meditate on the Passion of Christ. Now, coming up here in a few minutes, we're going to be talking with Paul Coughlin, changing gears and changing subjects a little bit. Dr. Laura Schlesinger, she's quite well known for her less than politically correct views of men and women. If you listen to her nationally syndicated radio program, you'll get that quite often. She has written a new book called The Proper Care and Feeding of Husbands, and Paul Coughlin has done a review of this book. Paul is a former newspaper editor and radio talk show host. He is currently a freelance writer, author, and photographer. He's author of the book Secrets, Plots, and Hidden Agendas. He joins us to talk about conspiracy theories on a regular basis, but today he joins us to talk about his review of Dr. Laura's latest book for audiobookcafe.com. Paul, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hey, Todd, great to be with you.
Your general impression of Dr. Laura's latest, The Proper Care and Feeding of Husbands?
You know, I think it's revolutionary. This book, I don't know if it could have been published a few years ago or maybe 10 years ago. Dr. Laura and I disagreed on that. She felt that it could have been. I don't know if the cultural landscape could have taken the tough medicine that she's got in this, but I think there's been a swing away from the damage done by radical and extreme feminism, particularly in relation to the genders, the gender differences. And as a result, I think our culture is a little more ready to hear a more balanced, level-headed approach toward the different sexes, and particularly how husbands and wives relate to each other.
What is the basic thesis of Dr. Laura's The Proper Care and Feeding of Husbands?
She contends that women have gotten away too easily in relation to when a relationship goes sour, that our culture, by and large, is largely points the finger at the man and says he's the fault for it. His overall attitude, either he's not sensitive, he's either too sensitive or he's not sensitive enough, doesn't pay enough attention, is too consumed with work. And she argues that women have actually been trained, been encouraged by our culture to not put as much into their marriage relationships as women have done in the past.
And how is that manifested? In what particular ways has the culture encouraged women to kind of slack off in their marriage relationships? How is that seen in the average marriage, according to Dr. Laura?
In the slacking off of it would be largely that the man is responsible for the overall health and care and well-being of the entire relationship. Also, too, there's been she would argue that there's been a degrading of men in our culture overall. And I tell you, when you look at the popular sitcoms and television shows, it's hard to argue with there. You know, you had Al Bundy of that horrible show, Married with Children. Though I'm a fan of Ray Romano, his character on Everybody Loves Raymond, you know, he's basically a bumbling fool, doesn't really know what's going on. Even his kids make fun of him. Homer Simpson's not exactly a very good role model. I know he's a cartoon, but you'd be hard. Well, look at all the male characters on Friends. There isn't one of them who shows any real backbone, any sort of masculinity. None of them are. They're all just kind of, you know, wimpish, and I think that's probably the way some of their, you know, women want that to be the case. So an overall degrading of men is what Dr. Laura argues.
Now, she basically says here, it seems, that if a man is talked to in a way that he understands, I generally talk about men and women having two different means of communication. Women communicate by telepathy, and men use language.
Yeah, right.
But if you talk with him directly, if you respect him, give him the appreciation that he deserves, you're not asking for any more than they deserve, food and affection, men will do just about anything a woman wants. Is this true?
She argues that that's pretty true. You know, a man's needs are pretty simple and straightforward. And you reminded me of the interview with her there when I interviewed her at her home in Southern California, she says that women hold an amazing amount of power in their relationships with their wives, with their husbands, and she argues it has not been used justly. She argues that they are largely the seat of power and that a man will do most anything to make his wife happy or try to make her happy. And she says that this level of power is yours intrinsically, and she's arguing use it justly. It's been used unfairly for 30, 40 years. It's time to bring about a fair use of power in these relationships.
Now, so Dr. Laura is not arguing that the roles that seem to be that prevail here, that she describes between men and women in marriage, ought to somehow be reversed or changed around. She's talking about women using their, quote, this is used advisedly, but quote-unquote advantage over men, using it rightly.
Using it rightly. She says that women have forgotten that they have it's their own happiness, too, that is at stake. That to have a harmony in your home, and this harmony comes from basically being respectful with your spouse, understanding, like you said, that, you know, the different communication styles, that don't speak to your husband, for example, as if he's another girlfriend. Men just don't respond that well, and they don't really want to talk that as much as women do on average. Yes, if this stuff is just understood and utilized and brought into the everyday aspect of life, women will find themselves being much happier than they would than what they currently are, which is to say somewhat at war you know, with the opposite sex.
What is the cause, the basic cause? Where does Dr. Laura lay the blame for the wife's mistreatment of the husband in the American family?
Great question. She would say that there was a time that the current battle didn't rage as much as it does today. And that was a time when mothers taught daughters how relationships really work, the basic nature of a man and the basic nature of a woman. Of course, there are exceptions to these things, but if a person wants to go through life trying to, you know, wiggle through the exceptions as opposed to the rules, they're going to find themselves in, you know, just great difficulty, consternation. And she says that what happened was radical feminism tried to change all sorts of things in regards to how the genders react. For example, radical feminism told me when I was in college at the University of Oregon that there is no difference between men and women from a biological and a psychological perspective. That was just pure, absolute nonsense. I remember a radical feminist standing up in class, literally shouting down a professor of biopsychology because he had the nerve to mention that a man's brain and a woman's brain are a little different, and as a result, they lead to a different kind of behavior, a different way of relating to the world and others. Well, we've had this mindset literally shoved down the throat of generations of women, generations of men as well. And so when they come into a relationship, you know, they're innately suspicious of men. And I don't know about you, Todd, but I will be attending weddings now when I see friends of ours who have daughters who graduate from large liberal universities. And I tell you, you just look at the way they look at their husband, and it's like, I can't trust you. It's like there's something behind their eyes that they're not willing to really melt with that man. And I, you know, radical feminism is the blame for it. And I think if you look at Dr. Laura's book, she is no fan of radical feminism.
You mentioned the popular TV sitcom Everybody Loves Raymond. The Romano character,
yeah,
is generally an affable fool. affable fool. The wife knows what's going on. The kids know better. Everybody else knows better, except for maybe that's why they love him so much. Last night's episode, when everyone else was watching Peter Jennings, I was watching Everybody Loves Raymond.
Okay, so was I.
And there was an attempt at the end to make things right, where the wife, the Patricia Heaton character, tries to build up her husband,
yeah,
in front of the kids, and the kids have a hard time taking it seriously. Is this what Dr. Laura is aiming at? It seems somewhat artificial to me.
That's a great observation. I would think that to some degree, yes, it is, because we find Deborah, the character, very pro-life person in real life, by the way, where she is trying to show a higher level of respect for her husband in front of her children. And sure, I would say to some degree, yes, that's what she's trying to do, is she's trying to reverse it. Todd, you know, from time to time, I have a talk show as well,
mm-hmm,
and I've brought this issue up with my Christian female listeners, and I talked about this book, and I wanted them to call in and say, hey, you know, is this working for you? I'd like to know. One woman called in, and Dr. Laura offers a pretty confident challenge to me when I interviewed her. She said, you know, I challenge a couple that's in difficulty to read this book and see if their marriage isn't better within 48 hours. And I had a woman call in, and she read this book. She said she cried, kind of repented for being disrespectful toward her husband. Not to say all women are disrespectful to the husband, but she says she was. And she says their marriage literally was better within 24 hours.
Psychologists, sociologists have told us for years, Paul, that the way a man treats his wife will largely influence how his sons will treat their wives and women throughout their lives. The way a woman treats her husband will also influence how their daughters will think of their future husbands and men in their lives. Is this basically the truth that Dr. Laura has tapped into?
Certainly. She really does have a heart for children in particular. You look at the foundation she does, you look at her website, and of course I was fortunate to have a conversation with her. Children, it really, really bothers her when children suffer the unfairness of the things that are out of their control, like divorce. For example, and I think a number of people have noticed that, even people who don't like her. Atlantic Monthly did a review of her book, and even the editor, the female editor with children, she you know, of course she's going to be more liberal than Dr. Laura, but even she bows and says, you know, this woman really does care about the health and well-being of family. You know, you read this book, and you're not going to find, flaming rhetoric. You're going to find some flaming sarcasm, and I have to say, it made me chuckle. There's parts in this book where she uses sarcasm as a battering ram to try to break up long-held misconceptions. I asked her about that because, you know, if you listen to her show, you know, she can be really, really blunt, and it's noticeable. And, you know, it's kind of her personality to begin with, but at the same time, she uses it as a tool because she doesn't have a whole lot of time with people to try to break up misconceptions. So, and again, she's out for the health and well-being of families, and you can tell her love for children and the desire to change around the type of thing that we've seen on an example of Everybody Loves Raymond, more respect for the husband.
Paul, finally, with only actually less than a minute here, what do you think the general reaction, the public reaction, will be to Dr. Laura's book, The Proper Care and Feeding of Husbands?
The people who I know have taken a look at this book say it's a profound book, smart book. I think the general reaction is going to be that it's going to make a lot of marriages a whole lot better, and it's going to talk some sense and sanity into a culture that's really lost an understanding of the differences between the gender.
Paul Coughlin, thank you for your review, and thanks for being our guest on Issues Etc.
It's always a great time.
Paul Coughlin is a former newspaper editor and radio talk show host occasionally. He is also currently a freelance writer, author, and photographer. He's author of the book Secrets, Plots, and Hidden Agendas, and a review of Dr. Laura's latest book for audiobookcafe.com. Just go there, audiobookcafe.com, and read Paul's review of The Proper Care and Feeding of Husbands. I remember doing premarital counseling as a parish pastor and telling the young men and women, especially the women, the young ladies, look, men are not that complicated. Generally speaking, what you see is what you get. Don't try to psychologize us because there's not that much there. We generally say what we mean. We generally expect to that people mean what they say. Our needs are very simple. Don't treat us like we're more sophisticated than we are, and speak to us in language that we can understand. You know, there are differences between the sexes. Thank God there are. That's what, the French would say. That would what puts the spice in life. And I would agree. We'll be right back with the second hour of Issues Etc. talking about the Passover.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.